In 1980, Marie and I were part of a church plant in Highland, California. Now, Highland is right next door to San Bernardino. When referring to the area in which we lived, we always referred to the greater San Bernardino area. I've never figured out why it's called the Inland Empire. I know it's inland, but I don't understand the empire part of it. We had a wonderful experience in Highland, San Bernardino. It was a growing experience, maturing. We learned a lot, and we loved the people in the church and in the community. But in 1986, we were called to another church in Aspen, Colorado. Now, I know what you're thinking. From San Bernardino to Aspen, what lucky star were we born under? But it gets better than that. We went from Aspen to Laguna Beach. Now, where do we go from here? I figure the next stop has to be heaven. And it was a wonderful experience being in Aspen, but a very difficult experience because it required of us huge cultural adjustments. There was a popular T-shirt in Aspen at the time. It said, "Aspen, where decadence is a way of life." Now, when we moved there, I have been a Los Angeles Raiders football fan, and they had recently won the Super Bowl. And in one of my first sermons in Aspen, I made reference to that fact, that the Raiders had won the Super Bowl. After the service, there were a group of men waiting for me with grim faces in the parking lot. And one of them, who has since become one of my very best friends, said, "Don't ever say that name again from the pulpit." And I said, what name is that? And he said, "Los Angeles Raiders." And I discovered that in order to move to Colorado, you had to convert. If you were a Seahawks fan, you had to convert. If you were a Cowboys fan, you had to convert. And if you were especially a Raiders or Chargers fan, it was absolutely essential for you to convert and become a Denver Broncos fan if you were ever to be able to settle into that community. The very next week, they brought a T-shirt. It was a black T-shirt. In silver letters, it said, "Raider Hater" on it. And I quickly discovered that it was difficult to assimilate to life in Aspen, but part of the assimilation required that you convert to the Broncos. Now, last week we learned that Daniel's resolve to live a godly life in Babylon was put to the test. When Daniel and his friends were taken captive, a deliberate attempt was made to assimilate them into Babylonian culture. They were given Babylonian names, taught the Babylonian language, given a Babylonian education, and they were asked to eat Babylonian food. Now, Daniel's policy was cooperation without compromise. But when push came to shove, when sacred principle was on the line, clearly, decisively, and respectfully, Daniel said no. He would neither conform nor participate when it came to the matter of eating the king's food. They remained inner strangers to the life and culture in which they were outwardly and fully involved. And that is the challenge for every one of us. The danger, as Jeff mentioned last week, is assimilation. To conform to the culture to such a degree that we lose our distinctiveness as people who love the Lord. "You are the salt of the earth," Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything. Now, like Daniel and his friends, we too will be tested. In the introduction to his commentary on the book of Daniel, John Calvin wrote, I have the very best occasion of showing you, beloved brethren, in this mirror. He likened the book of Daniel to looking at yourself in a mirror. In this mirror, how God proves the faith of his people in these days by various trials, and how with wonderful wisdom he has taken care to strengthen their minds by ancient examples, namely Daniel and his friends. And they should never be weakened by the concussion of the severest storms, or at least, if they should totter at all, that they should never finally be swept away. For although the servants of God are required to run in a course impeded by many obstacles, yet whoever diligently reads this book, the book of Daniel, will find in it whatever is needed by a voluntary and active runner to guide him from the starting point to the goal. So Calvin likened the book of Daniel and those who read the book of Daniel and benefit from it as those that are running a race that has many obstacles that must be avoided in order to reach the finish line. Now in chapter 2, Daniel says yes, just as clearly and decisively and respectfully as he had said no in chapter 1. Much is at stake. Many lives depend on a correct answer, including his own. A false step here will spell disaster. But Daniel steps into the breach, and God gives him the wisdom and strength he needs to meet the crisis. And by doing so, he becomes one link in a long chain of godly men and women through whom God fulfills his promise that through the descendants of Abraham, the whole world will be blessed. Now, Daniel was probably 19 or 20 years old at this time, just a teenager. Amazing. He has completed 3 years of study at Babylon University, majoring in the Babylonian language and literature. He has shown a keen aptitude for interpreting dreams and visions. He and his three friends excel in their studies and graduate at the top of their class. All of that we learned in Daniel chapter 1. They are the best and the brightest of the class of 602 BC. Their wisdom and academic achievement earns them a special audience with the king. But they are still enrolled in God's school of character development. In fact, this is a school in which we are all enrolled and from one from which we never graduate. And as we shall see, God has a special curriculum planned for them. Now, King Nebuchadnezzar stood in the background in chapter 1, but in chapter 2, he steps out of the shadows and comes center stage. He has much to show for his first 2 years on the throne. Yet he is troubled by recurring nightmares. Daniel 2, verse 1. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means." Now, Nebuchadnezzar means, "O Nebu, protect my offspring." Nebu was the Babylonian deity of wisdom and the son of the god Marduk, who was the chief god of Babylon. In an ancient inscription, Nebuchadnezzar fancies himself as Nabu's beloved and Nabu's favorite. Something of the king's character can be gleaned from his inaugural address to Marduk, the chief god of Babylon. And he says, "As my precious life, do I love thy sublime appearance." He was referring to a statue of Marduk in the temple there in Babylon. "At thy command, O merciful Marduk, may the house that I have built endure forever. May I be satiated with its splendor, attain old age therein with abundant offspring, and receive therein tribute of the kings of all regions from all mankind. We see that it was Nebuchadnezzar's desire to be worshipped and to be the most famous man on the earth and to be rich and powerful. Now, one of his oracles, the prophet Isaiah, made fun of Nebuchadnezzar's god, Nebu. Isaiah 46, verses 1 through 7. Isaiah says, Bel bows down, Nebo stoops low. Their idols are borne by beasts of burden. The images that are carried about are burdensome, a burden for the weary. They stoop and bow down together, unable to rescue the burden. They themselves go off into captivity. Listen to me, O house of Jacob, all you who remain of the house of Israel, you whom I have upheld since you were conceived and have carried since your birth, even to your old age and gray hairs, I am he. I am he who will sustain you. I have made you, and I will carry you. I will sustain you, and I will rescue you. To whom will you compare me or count me equal? To whom will you liken me that we may be compared? Some pour out gold from their bags and weigh out silver on the scales. They hire a goldsmith to make it into a god, and they bow down and worship it. They lift it to their shoulders and carry it. They set it up in its place, and there it stands. From that spot, it cannot move. Though one cries out to it, it does not answer. It cannot save him from his troubles. Now, Isaiah is saying, if a god has to be carried, how can it carry you? If a god can't help itself, how can it help you? If a god needs your strength, then how can it strengthen you? Now, Nebuchadnezzar was troubled by his dreams, but he had no concept of God Almighty as the great, unchanging, just, and eternal God, or as a loving, merciful Father. All of these attributes were foreign to his understanding of God. Now, notice that Isaiah does not say that Bel and Nebo are just different names for the same God everyone worships. He is saying that the gods of the nations are not gods at all. They are pathetic burdens. They have nothing to offer us but weariness. They cannot save us. They are more trouble than they are worth. Now, how different is the Lord's relationship with his people? No contrast could be greater. His people do not carry him. Rather, he carries them. And moreover, he always has and he always will. There is not one moment that God is not carrying you and me along. God is bearing us up moment by moment by his grace. Now, Nebuchadnezzar had tremendous power and wealth. He became the most powerful ruler of his time, the greatest warrior, statesman, builder of all the Babylonian kings. His word was never questioned, nor his will disputed. And yet, night after night, he was troubled by these nightmares. And he felt increasingly insecure, a nagging sense that his kingdom was threatened by something or someone beyond his control. Uneasy lies the head that wears a crown. Henry IV by Shakespeare. In the Babylonian culture, in order to control one's destiny, to find one's way through the varied events of life, to stay one step ahead of those who are plotting to overthrow you, one had to determine the will of the gods. Now, for very practical reasons, ancient people, like people today, wish to know what tomorrow might bring. Success in business, war, diplomacy, and romance depended on it. This was very complicated because the gods of the Babylonians were exceedingly numerous. There were 65,000 of them. And various methods were used to determine the will of the gods. such as examining the entrails of sacrificed animals, casting of lots, consulting the spirits of the dead, watching a flock of birds in flight, or noting the movements of the stars in the sky. A king's fate could even be forecast by observing the movements of a dog walking down the street. Now, the ancient Babylonians, like the Egyptians, also put a great deal of stock in dreams, because it was commonly believed that the gods communicated to human beings through this channel. Information about the future could be downloaded from the gods through a dream. Dreams were considered to be either good or bad. If the forecast one received for the future was dire, corrective steps could be taken to prevent those bad things from happening. Now, the reason for this is that dreams contained omens, which means that a dream is meaningful only when correctly interpreted by an expert. A person would never bother to interpret their own dreams. They would have to go find a professional dream expert to explain their dream to them. The reason for that is that it was understood that their dreams were messages from the gods. So in order to understand a dream, Babylonians consulted a specialist who could have been a priest or a professional dream interpreter. And the dream experts would listen to your dream, and then they would look up dreams in a dream book to help them with the interpretation. Some of these ancient dream books have actually survived. The British Museum has some samples of it, one that is 5,000 years old. It is a papyrus that comes from Egypt, and there are two columns. One column is good dreams, one column is bad dreams, and written in the middle in red letters is an explanation of what to do if you have a good dream or what to do if you have a bad dream. The idea was to keep one step ahead of the gods and the spirits in order to keep control of your life. For example, if you have a dream about swimming in a lake, that meant one thing. Or if you were being chased by crows, that meant something else. I one time had a dream about being chased all around my house by a tiger. That meant another thing. The key is you have to have an expert interpret it for you, and they will look it up in their dream book. Now, the dream books contain rituals for warding off the consequences of bad dreams. So for my tiger dream, the interpreter would simply look up tiger chasing you in the house, ask a few questions about it, and then here is what you have to do in order to prevent that tiger or whatever the tiger represents from harming you. And so what happens is, since dream interpreters were held in such high esteem, nearly every leader had an interpreter on hand, usually more than one. And Nebuchadnezzar had a whole team of them. They practiced the occult, sorcery, astrology, and incantations in order to do their work. Now, God warned the Israelites to have nothing to do with pagan divination in its various forms. That's in Deuteronomy 18 and Leviticus 19. And so it is unlikely that Daniel and his friends participated in these practices. A. Leo Oppenheim, who was one of the most distinguished Assyriologists of his generation, wrote, "Divination represents a technique of communication with the supernatural forces that are supposed to shape the history of the individual as well as that of the group. It presupposes the belief that these powers are able and at times willing to communicate their intentions, and that if evil is predicted or threatened, it can be averted through appropriate means." I suppose this was the Babylonian form of the CIA, or whatever organization assesses threats that are to the American security. Now, the Babylonians used the messages in their dreams in order to cure illnesses, make important state decisions, decide where to build a temple, know where to wage a battle, know what stocks to invest in, and know which man or woman you should marry. And even the Jewish captives were working on their own dream interpretation books at this time. There's a part of the Jewish Hebrew Talmud, which was written during the Babylonian captivity. Part of that is devoted to dream interpretations and ways of dealing with dreams. There is a certain Rabbi Hisda, for example, who said, "A dream which is not interpreted is like a letter which is not read." Now the question is, a letter from whom? Now, Nebuchadnezzar was deeply troubled by his dreams. He felt he had received some kind of a message, but he couldn't figure out what it meant. And that's why he called for his counselors to help him interpret the message. Daniel 2, verse 4. Then the astrologers answered the king, "May the king live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we'll interpret it." The king replied to the astrologers, "This is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me what my dream was and interpret it, I will have you cut into pieces and your houses turned into piles of rubble." The actual Hebrew says into a latrine. "But if you tell me the dream and explain it, you will receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. So tell me the dream and interpret it to me." "Once more," they replied, "let the king tell his servants the dream and we'll interpret it." Then the king answered, "I am certain that you are trying to gain time, because you realize that this is what I have firmly decided. If you do not tell me the dream, there is only one penalty for you, and that isn't being fired, they're going to be put to death. You have conspired to tell me misleading and wicked things, hoping the situation will change. So then, tell me the dream, and I will know that you can interpret it for me." Now Nebuchadnezzar calls for all of his court counselors and asked them to tell him not only the interpretation of the dream, but the content of the dream itself. He apparently reasoned that if they had the powers of divination they claimed, they ought to be able to relate what he had dreamed, for surely their gods would know this and be able to pass it on to them. If, however, he simply related the dream to them at first, then they might invent some interpretation that suited their purposes. Now, these magicians, astrologers, and sorcerers were men of great intellect and learning, but they were unable to give the slightest help. Their dream books were of no use. Their spells and incantations could not conjure up an answer to the king's question. Even the stargazers were stumped. So they say, "Tell us the dream, and we'll give you the interpretation." But the king wasn't buying their dodge. He ordered them to tell him his dream and then to give the meaning. And they told them that was simply impossible. So verse 10, the astrologers answered the king, "There is no one on earth who can do what the king asks." They are wrong about that. "No king, however, great and mighty, has ever asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or astrologer." They were right about that. "What the king asks is too difficult." Yes, it was. It was impossible. "No one can reveal it to the king except the gods, and they do not live among humans." "Is that your final answer?" he asked. "Yes," they replied. "Fine. You're all going to die." So he ordered all of his wise men put to death, and that could have been into the hundreds of people. Now, verse 12, "This made the king so angry and furious that he ordered the execution of all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree was issued to put the wise men to death, and men were sent to look for Daniel and his friends to put them to death. When Arioch, the commander of the king's guard, had gone out to put to death the wise men of Babylon, Daniel spoke to him with wisdom and tact. He asked the king's officer, "Why did the king issue such a harsh decree?" Arioch then explained the matter to Daniel. At this, Daniel went to the king and asked for time so that he might interpret the dream for him. And so an execution squad has been sent to Daniel's house to carry out the king's order. And the squad was led by Arioch, the captain of the guard. Now the appearance of Arioch with a detachment of soldiers must have been very frightening. But Daniel had the presence of mind to inquire why the king had ordered such a severe decree. Now, the fact that Arioch doesn't lop off his head on the spot speaks well of Daniel's character and of Arioch's high regard for him. The fact is that God's favor was on Daniel. And so Daniel personally asked the king for more time. Then he and his three friends prayed for guidance. Verse 17, then Daniel returned to his house and explained the matter to his friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. He urged them to plead for mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that he and his friends might not be executed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Now, I think Daniel is not simply acting to save his own skin and of his friends. He is acting by faith in God, who he knows is working in this situation. Daniel acts in complete confidence that God would give him the wisdom he needs to solve any problem, the strength to face any threat. Now, for a young man who is only 18 or 19 years old, that's pretty amazing. But we too can have that same confidence. James 1, 5 and 6, if any of you lacks wisdom, he should ask God, who gives generously to all without finding fault, and it will be given to him. But when he asks, he must believe and not doubt, because he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, blown and tossed by the wind. Now, how do we handle impossible situations? What do we learn from Daniel's experience? Number one, note what Daniel did not do. He didn't panic. He didn't freak out. He didn't overact. He didn't become paralyzed with fear. He didn't cry out, "This is so unfair, call my lawyer." He was young in years, but he was wise in the ways of God and recognized that an impossible situation could only be resolved by God's intervention. Our obstacles are God's opportunities to show himself great and mighty in our behalf. You know, I don't think a crisis makes a man. I think a crisis reveals a man. Had Daniel not been a disciplined man of God, had he been a lazy, disloyal worker, he would not have had the faith to face this crisis. And he certainly would not have had favor with the king. The second thing we see here is that when we're faced with impossible situations is we ask relevant questions to get the facts. That's what Daniel does. Give me some background, Arioch, on why the king has made this decision. Help me understand this. And it's always good to do this when we face any situation, to get as much information as we can so that we can make an informed response to the crisis at hand. The third thing he does is he asks for time. Sometimes it takes a while to make an informed response. It takes time to hear from God, to get a clear answer from God. Again, we see God's hand is involved in the daily affairs of Daniel's life. And he knew that only God could turn the king's heart. Fourthly, he asked trusted friends to help him seek God's wisdom. C.S. Lewis said in The Four Loves, "Friendship can be a school of virtue, but also a school of vice. It makes good men better, but bad men worse." Proverbs 13:20 says, "He who walks with the wise grows wise, but a companion of fools suffers harm." Fifthly, we ask God for wisdom. Note the sequence of event. Daniel did not go back and consult the magic books of Babylon. Instead, he called a prayer meeting to consult the Most High God of the universe. Now, Daniel 1:17 tells us that Daniel was gifted in interpretation of dreams and visions. But even with a gift, you have to develop the gift. And so that's what we see here. He makes a wise choice to humble himself before the giver of every good thing bestowed and every perfect gift and seek his face in prayer. There were two men in the Bible who were known to be gifted in the areas of dream interpretation. That was Daniel, and the other was Joseph. And I know a few today who have this gift, but they will tell you that with the gift has come a lot of practice, a lot of time, on their knees before God, learning the gift, honing the gift, knowing how to move in the power of the Holy Spirit with that gift. Tremper Longman says, wisdom is not a lesson to be learned, but a relationship to be enjoyed. And that's what Daniel and his friends do. They have conversation with God. Daniel's wisdom, contrary to the Babylonian court magicians, did not come from books on dream interpretation. Instead, it came from conversation with God. True wisdom is the result of a relationship with God who created and rules over the world. Sixthly, we thank God for the wisdom when it is given. Verse 19, during the night the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, praise be to the name of God forever and ever. Wisdom and power are his. He changes times and seasons. He deposes kings and raises up others. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. Nice to know this around election time. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank and praise you, God of my ancestors. You have given me wisdom and power. You have made known to me what we asked of you. You have made known to us the dream of the king. Now notice when Daniel receives answer to his prayer, his first instinct is not to go run and tell the king. He breaks out into humble and astonished praise. Daniel praises the God of heaven for two things, for wisdom and for power. And he gives four examples. Number one, God changes times and seasons through his control of history. Number two, one way he does this is by removing and establishing kings. Number three, he gives wisdom and knowledge where he sees it to be needed. And sometimes we come to a place in our lives where we reach a crossroads. We don't know to go backwards, forward, to the left, or the right. And we're just puzzled. And in those times, we get down on our knees and we ask the Lord for guidance. Many years ago, I had the privilege of participating in a ministry team from this church that went down to Tijuana to deliver food to an orphanage on the other side of the border. This was a ministry that the Campbells, Don and Susie Campbell, had organized. And we went down in a caravan of vehicles, and I was in a pickup truck with all of the food, the sacks of beans and rice in the back of the pickup truck. The person who was driving was a friend of mine named Howard. And the idea was we'd all go down in a caravan so we wouldn't get separated, so we would know how to get to the orphanage. Unfortunately, at the border, we got separated from the other vehicles, and when we got into Tijuana, we had absolutely no idea where the orphanage was. If you've ever been in Tijuana, you know you get into the central area there, and there's kind of a rotary, and you can go around and around and around in a circle, and the roads kind of are like spokes of a wheel. You have five or six different choices of which way you can go. And if you don't know which way to go, you could spend half the day just going around and around. And Howard kept saying, which one do we take? Which one do we take? And I had no idea. Is it east or west or north? I have no idea. So finally, we decided, okay, Howard said, you choose, and I'll just take that road. And finally I said, okay, go right here. And so that's what we did. And we were heading east. We stopped for directions, and as men, you know how desperate you are if you have to stop in directions. And neither one of us spoke Spanish. And all we knew was that it was an orphanage next to a garbage dump. And what's the Spanish word for garbage dump? We had no idea. We tried drawing it. We acted it out, you know, this kind of stuff. And everybody was just looking at us, you know, what? We couldn't figure out where do we go to drop off this food. And we're the whole reason why we had this trip in the first place. All the food is in the back of the truck. So we just keep driving east, and we come to a four-way stop in the middle of nowhere. And we just stopped and said, you know what, either we got to find a church and drop this off there, or we're just going to go back home. But now we weren't even sure how to get home, let alone find the orphanage. We stopped, closed our eyes and we said, Lord, give us wisdom, show us what to do, we're completely lost. We opened our eyes, and just as we opened our eyes, the caravan was driving past. And we went, oh, you know, we jumped into line and they led us directly to the orphanage. And I've often thought about that day with Howard Sidewater, the adventure we had trusting God for directions. Sometimes we find ourselves in those situations and like Daniel, we get down on our knees and we ask God for the wisdom. Now finally, Daniel thanks God for answering his prayer. Though he is weak and knows nothing, Daniel is nevertheless strong and knows everything because he is trusting the living God. A dream which is not interpreted is like a letter which is not read. Yes, Nebuchadnezzar, you've got mail. And what a message. The mystery that is explained to Daniel by God in a night vision concerns how human history was going to unfold through the rise and fall of four kingdoms. But that's next Sunday's sermon. It's important to understand that Daniel was not quick to give an interpretation. God reveals deep and hidden things. God glorifies himself through the interpretation given to Daniel. Daniel didn't take any glory for himself. He gave all the glory to God. The Holy Spirit is the dream interpreter. All interpretations belong to God. Pharaoh had a dream, and he asked Joseph to explain what it meant. I can't do it, Joseph replied to Pharaoh, but God will give Pharaoh the answer he desires. In time, God gave Joseph the interpretation of Pharaoh's dream. Then they said to him, Genesis 40, verse 8, we have had a dream and there is no one to interpret it. Then Joseph said to them, do not interpretations belong to God? Tell it to me, please. And that's exactly what God did. Shakespeare's Macbeth surmised, life is but a walking shadow. A poor player that struts and frets its hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Macbeth got it right. If the God of heaven doesn't exist. But the Bible reveals that God does exist and he is sovereign over history. That is the message of the book of Daniel. History is no accident, and life on this planet is not a matter of survival of the fittest. History is going exactly the way God planned it to go, and the planet is not careening out of control, even though meteors are falling in Russia. The Bible clearly shows that God is committed to the universe he created. History, in fact, is his story. Now, for your own history to be under control, for you to reach your full potential, your own personal history needs to come under control of the God of history, Jesus Christ. Now, the Apostle Paul wrote in Colossians 2, 2 and 3, my goal is that you may be encouraged in heart and united in love so that you may have the full riches of complete understanding in order that you may know the mystery of God, namely Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge.